10:45, the time Miss Devine's train was due to arrive from London. But had the warden remembered to warn her? I went downstairs and crossed the court. There was no light in her room, but the curtains were drawn across. I opened the door.
Oh, filthy bitch! I'm going to kill you as you killed him!
We present Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter Wimsey and Joanna David as Harriet Vane in Gaudy Night by Dorothy L. Sayers.
I wouldn't try to sit up.
I've got the beast of a headache.
The rest of you's in one piece, thank goodness.
What happened?
That's what we'd all like to know. Oh, poor Miss Devine's train was a bit late, and when she got here, Paget told her the warden wanted to see her. So she went along to her room to take her hat off, and of course the light wouldn't go on. But she could hear you snorting on the floor in the dark.
Oh.
She managed to find the table lamp, and there you are. A nasty, bloggy sight for a respectable woman to find in her sitting room. So she rushed out, calling for help, and ran about all over the place until somebody fetched the warden. And then her groggy heart went back on her and she went all blue on us. We had a lovely time, but she's right as rain now.
Quite a gaudy night. I'm sorry I missed it.
And then, just as we were settling down, all the fuss started again about Annie.
Annie? What happened to her?
We found her in the coal hole in such a state. What with coal dust and hammering with her fists on the door. I wonder she wasn't clean off her head, poor thing. And if it hadn't been for Lord Peter, we mightn't even have begun to look for her before next morning.
Yes, he warned her she might be attacked. But how did he... Did you get him on the phone or what?
Yes, eventually. It took us some time to get hold of his phone number, and it was midnight before I managed to speak to him. He said he'd drive down from London at once, and then he asked if anything had happened to Annie Wilson, which set us off trying to find where she'd got to. It was 2 o'clock in the morning before Lord Peter arrived.
He must have thought I was an awful idiot to let myself be knocked out like that.
He looked like death, and of course he'd been driving like mad. He came in to see you, but you were still rather under the weather. And he explained about the dog collar, which had rather puzzled us.
I suppose she really meant to get Miss Devine. But you still hadn't told me about Annie. How did she get into the coal cellar?
Apparently she was putting the deck chairs away in the loggia when somebody seized her round the neck from behind, frog-marched her into the cellar, locked her in and took away the key. She said it was a woman, and very strong.
She certainly was. She had a grip like steel. Is Peter still here?
No, he had to go. Something about an early plane from Croydon. He went off leaving orders that neither you, nor Mr. Vine, nor Annie were to be left alone for a single moment. And he's rung up once from London and 3 times from Paris.
Poor old Peter. He never seems to get a moment's rest.
And he hopes to be back on Thursday and is going to call us all together. Oh, he left you a letter.
Congratulations on not being dead yet. I've taken away your collar to have my name put on it.
If things carry on like this, we shall have to make them standard issue.
Thursday. A heavy, gloomy and depressing Thursday. The warden had called a meeting of the senior common room, and Peter was to lay certain information before them.
The first point to strike an outsider is the fact that these demonstrations began at the Gaudy. I may say that this was a crucial error on the part of the perpetrator, whom I shall refer to in the time-honoured way as X.
You mean that if X had waited until after term began, we would have had a much wider field of suspects?
Exactly. What was it that so excited X the Gaudy that she couldn't wait until a more advantageous time? Was there a person who was newly arrived at college when the Gaudy took place, and who was resident the following term when the demonstrations began in earnest? And there was. Mr. Vine. The first indications of the trouble were the documents which came into the hands of Miss Vane at the time of the Gaudy. One of them, which amounted to an accusation of murder, was slipped into her gown in the senior common room, and her gown was side by side with that of Mr. Vine. I believe that X, misreading H.D. Vane for D. Vine, simply put the note into the wrong gown.
I was certain, of course, that the letter was intended for me. Why should anyone accuse Mr. Vine of murder?
Precisely. Miss Vane also discovered a drawing on the night of the Gordy. She destroyed it, but I gather it looked something like this.
Oh.
It represents a punishment being inflicted by a naked female figure upon another clothed in academic dress. And similar drawings appeared thrust under doors or scrawled upon walls throughout the Michaelmas term. And there was a curious variation. A crude picture of a man being killed by a female, also in academic dress.
I must admit that the significance of the academic dress escaped me. I thought the drawings were simply obscene.
And that interpretation managed to obscure the real issue. In the disfigurement of your manuscript, Miss Lydgate, did you notice any common factor in the sections which were almost totally obliterated?
Yes. They concerned my criticism of the conclusions of other scholars. And now I come to think of it, they were all male.
But when we come to the attack on the new library, the object of the campaign begins to show itself more clearly. The grievance felt by X, which started with one person, has extended itself to the whole college with the intention of causing a scandal which would bring the entire body into disrepute. And I must say that the one thing which frustrated the whole attack was the remarkable solidarity displayed by your college as a body. I think that was the last obstacle X reckoned to encounter in a community of women.
Thank you. I feel sure that everybody here will know how to appreciate that.
Well, it was about this time that Miss Vane made the acquaintance of my nephew, St. George, and he mentioned to her that, under circumstances into which we need not perhaps inquire, he had met a mysterious woman one night in your fellow's garden, and that she had told him that Shrewsbury College was a place where they mutilated beautiful boys like him and ate their hearts out. And secondly, that the other one had fair hair too. And so we have a little detail about the person who is supposed to have been murdered, in inverted commas. He is fair and reasonably handsome. Then followed the affair of the fuses, and, more importantly, the letters to Miss Newland.
I cannot imagine why they are making all that noise beneath this building. I wonder, Dean, would you be so good as to
go... Look, I'm afraid I am responsible for that. I suggested to Paget that a search of the coal cellar might be profitable.
Well, in that case, I fear we must put up with it.
Now, I gathered from Miss Vane that she and others among you were inclined to look upon the outrages as the outcome of the repression that sometimes accompanies the celibate life.
Rather like the obscene carvings one sometimes finds in ancient monasteries.
But the direction of X's campaign seemed to me to revolve round the supposed murder of a male person by a female academic. The picture of X, suggested by all this, was someone with a fiercely anti-academic bias, which seemed to rule out all of yourselves. And then I began to consider the practicalities. It was plain that X had to be someone who resided within the college. But there was the curious circumstance of the letters which came by post.
You mean that they only came on Mondays and Thursdays?
Which suggests that whoever posted them could only go outside on Sundays and Wednesdays.
Exactly, Mr. Vine. And X also needed to have a place somewhere outside college where the clothes she used for prowling about the corridors at night and the dress found on the dummy in the chapel could be kept and the letters prepared.
The letter factory and the science laboratory was obviously an attempt to divert our suspicions.
Indeed it was. So the person who seemed best to fulfil these conditions appeared to be one of the scouts.
But that's out of the question, surely.
The majority of them, however, seemed to be ruled out. Most of those in the scouts' wing slept two to a room, but there were two who had separate rooms, Carrie, the head scout, and Annie Wilson. And Annie corresponded most closely to the psychological picture of X.
She'd been married, she had Sunday and Wednesday afternoons off, and she had a place outside college where her children lived.
Oh, this is preposterous.
There was one consideration which led Miss Vane to eliminate all the scouts.
The Latin quotation from Virgil pinned to the dummy with a knife.
But this objection did not carry a great deal of weight with me. I thought there must be something special about a passage that describes hideous and unnatural females who snatch the meat from men's mouths.
When I first heard of that, I felt sure there was a man behind it all.
That was probably a sound instinct, as will become clear. My first task was to find out whether Mr. Vine had ever actually murdered or injured anybody.
Do you mean to say that the interminable discussion that night was intended merely to bring out Mr. Vine's story about the man's thesis?
I'm afraid it was. And the next day, I asked Mr. Vine for the name of the man in question. He was Arthur Robinson.
And did you find out what happened to him?
He was married to a woman called Charlotte Ann Clark, who had been his landlady's daughter. They had two children, Beatrice and Carola.
Beatrice and Carola?
After the trouble over the thesis, he changed his name to Wilson and took a post as a junior master in a prep school. But I'm afraid he took to drink. Lost their job and took another. Lost that, and 3 years ago, he blew his brains out.
Oh, no.
There were photographs in the local paper. Here it is. A fair, handsome man. Something of my nephew's type. And here is a photograph of his widow.
Yes, that is Annie Wilson.
If you read the report of the inquest, you will see that he left a letter saying that he had been hounded to death. It contained a Latin quotation, which the coroner translated.
Tristius haudilis monstrum.
The lines that were pinned to the dummy.
So you were right, Miss Hilliard. A man was behind it. Annie Wilson, being obliged to do something to support her children and herself, went into service and applied for a job here. She probably knew that as a widow with two children, she would receive kindly consideration.
What did I tell you? I always said that ridiculous sentimentality about married women would be the ruin of this college.
Poor soul, brooding over her grievance in such an unbalanced way. If only we had known, we could have surely done something to make her see things in a more rational light. Well, did it never occur to you, Mr. Vine, to inquire what happened to that unhappy man?
I'm afraid it did not.
Why should you?
So it was Annie Wilson who attacked Miss Vane.
Oh, yes. I find it difficult to forgive myself for not having spoken earlier, with or without proof, to put the suspect under observation.
Oh, nonsense. If you had, she might have chucked the whole thing for the rest of term, and we should still know nothing. I wasn't much hurt.
No, but it might not have been you. I knew you were willing to take the risk, but I had no right to expose Mr. Vine.
Well, it seems to me that the risk was rightly and properly mine.
But if Annie really did this dreadful thing, how does she come to get shut in the curl hole?
Excuse me, Madam Warden. Ladies?
I think we are about to discover that.
Here you are, Lord Peter. Here's the cellar key. Right at the bottom of the coal heap.
So, she locked herself in and hid the key in a desperate attempt to divert suspicion from herself.
Oh.
Thank you, Padgett.
One moment, Padgett. I want to see Annie Wilson. Will you please find her and bring her here?
I don't think that is a very good idea.
You have made a public accusation against this unfortunate woman, and it is only right that she should be given the chance to answer it. Bring her here at once, Padgett.
Annie came in wan and subdued, and then she noticed the newspaper containing the photographs of herself and her husband spread out upon the table. Her eyes went round the room like a hunted animal.
Annie, certain allegations have been made against you concerning the disturbances in this college, and I have sent for you in order that you might clear yourself.
Clear myself? I wouldn't trouble to clear myself. I'd like to see you bring me into court. How would you look, you smug hypocrites, sitting there while I told the judge how that woman killed my husband?
I'm exceedingly disturbed. I knew nothing of this until just now. But I could not foresee the consequences. I mean, even if I had...
You wouldn't have cared. You killed him and you didn't care. What harm had he done to anybody? He only wanted to live and be happy. He told a lie about somebody who was dead as dust hundreds of years ago. Nobody was the worse for that. Was a dirty piece of paper more important than our lives and happiness? You broke him and you killed him. Do you think that's a woman's job?
Most unhappily, it was my job.
What business had you with a job like that? A woman's job is to look after her husband and children. I loved my husband and you broke his heart. If he'd have been a thief and a murderer, I'd have loved him and stuck to him.
Annie, you must surely understand that...
Understand? any of you understand with all your books and your learning? You're ignorant and stupid and helpless, you silly old hags. You even had to get a man to do your work for you. You brought him here, Miss Vane, and you're the dirtiest hypocrite of the lot. You had a lover once and he died. You chucked him out because you were too proud to marry him. You were his mistress and you sucked him dry. And what are you going to do with this one here? You send for him when you need him to do your dirty work, and when you've finished with him, you'll get rid of him. You'll use him like any other tool to break me. You'd like to see me in prison and my children in a home because you haven't got the guts to do your proper job in the world. The old bunch of you together haven't got flesh and blood enough to make you fit for a man. And as for you, your lordship, you rotten little white-faced rat, it's men like you that make women like this. You don't know how to do anything but talk. That woman's making a fool of you and you can't even see it. Well, what are you going to do now, all of you? Run away to the magistrate because I made fools of you all? You daren't touch me. You're afraid of me. I had a husband, and I loved him, and you killed him! You killed him, and we never had a happy moment ever again!
For heaven's sake, can't this be stopped?
No, come, Annie. We're all very sorry for you, but you mustn't behave in this hysterical way. What would your children... No, shh! You'd better come and lie down quietly and take some aspirin with her. Will you help me out with her?
I apologise for allowing this scene to take place. I ought to have known better, Lord Peter. You were perfectly right.
Of course he was right. He's always right. He said it was dangerous to care for anybody. He said love was the devil. Oh, God, get me out of here. I'm going to be sick.
And of course, Miss Devine, no sane person could think of blaming you.
Nobody, perhaps, but myself.
Lord Peter, a little later on, when we are feeling more ourselves... I think we should like to say
Look
that we...
Please, 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 please don't. It doesn't matter at all.
Then I think we should bring to an end these proceedings. Good afternoon.
I do blame myself. Most bitterly. Not for my original action, but for the sequel.
But surely...
Nothing you can say to me could make me feel more responsible than I do already.
I can have nothing to say. Like you and every member of this common room, I admit the principle, and the consequences must follow.
Yes, but that won't do. One ought to take some thought for other people. Miss Lydgate would have done what I did in the first place, but she would have made it her business to see what became of that unhappy man and his wife.
Miss Lydgate is a very rare person, but she couldn't prevent other people from suffering for her principles. That seems to be what principles are for, somehow.
How much are you going to suffer for this?
Oh, God knows. That's my lookout. In any case, you know I'm with you. Every time.
Oh, thank heaven they've gone. I'm afraid I made rather an exhibition of myself.
Well...
What's happened to Peter?
Oh, he's gone too. Miss Vane... I've no wish to pry impertinently into your affairs, but we've had to face a good many facts this afternoon. Isn't it time you faced the facts about this man?
I have been facing one fact for some time. That is that if I once gave way to Peter, I should go up like straw.
Oh, that is moderately obvious. How often has he used that weapon against you?
Never.
Then what are you afraid of? Yourself?
Isn't this afternoon warning enough?
Perhaps. But I really don't think you can go on like this. He looks like a person pushed to the last verge of endurance.
I should make his life a misery.
Very well. If you are determined that you are not fit to lick his boots, tell him so and send him away.
I've been trying to send Peter away for 5 years. It doesn't have that effect on him.
If you had really tried, you could have sent him away in 5 minutes. He'll never make up your mind for you. You needn't be afraid of losing your independence. He'll always force it back on you.
If you were me, would you marry a man like that?
Well, frankly, I should not. A marriage of two independent and equally irritable intelligences seems to me reckless to the point of insanity. You can hurt each other so dreadfully.
I know, and I don't think I can stand being hurt anymore.
Then I suggest you stop hurting other people. Face the facts and state a conclusion. Bring a scholar's mind to the problem and have done with it.
There was no word from Peter in the morning, and I was in no mood to face the senior common room. I took myself off to the Radcliffe Camera to try to occupy my mind with Sheridan Le Fanu. Shortly after noon, a hand touched my shoulder.
Harriet, they told me I'd find you here. Can you spare a moment? We could go up to the gallery if you wish.
Of course.
I understand that poor Annie's problem is being medically dealt with.
Oh, yes. When the academic mind has really grasped a hypothesis, which may take a little time, of course, it copes with thoroughness and efficiency. Nothing will be overlooked.
One can only hope she survives the process.
We walked out onto the gallery of the Camera. The sun was shining upon a shining city, all Oxford springing underneath in living leaf and enduring stone, tinged far off by her sheltering blue hills.
Harriet, I want to ask your forgiveness for these last 5 years.
I think it ought to be the other way round.
No, I think not. When I remember how first we met...
Peter, I was sick of myself, body and soul. I didn't know what I was doing.
I had found you beyond all hope and expectation at a time when I thought no woman could ever mean anything to me beyond a little easy exchange of pleasure. I was so terrified of losing you before I could grasp you that I babbled out all my greed and fear as though, God help me, you had nothing to think of but me and my windy self-importance.
No, Peter.
My dear, you showed me what you thought of me when you said you would live with me but never marry me.
Don't. I'm ashamed of that.
Ah, not so bitterly ashamed as I've been. It has taken me a long time to learn my lesson, Harriet. I've had to pull down, brick by brick, the barriers I had built by my own selfishness.
Peter, it's not fair to let you talk like this. It's I who ought to apologize. If I owe you nothing else, I owe you my self-respect, and I owe you my life.
Ah, but I've given you that back by letting you risk it the other night, and nearly losing it in the process. That was the last kick that sent my vanity out of doors.
Peter, I did manage to appreciate that. I heard that you collected 5 summonses for speeding on your drive from London to here. Mayn't I be grateful?
I don't want your gratitude.
But won't you take it now that I want to give it to you?
Then I have no right to refuse. Let that clear all scores, Harriet. You've given me far more than you know. You are free now and forever, as far as I'm concerned. You saw yesterday what personal claims might lead to, though I didn't intend you to see it quite that brutal way. But I couldn't see how I could have prevented it.
Yes, you wouldn't falsify the facts to support a thesis.
What would have been the good? What could I ever have gained by letting you imagine a lie? I set out in a lordly way to offer you heaven and earth. I find that all I have to give you is Oxford, which was yours already. Enter into your heritage.
Peter, I... Oh, damn.
No, don't worry, don't worry. It's quite all right. Hey, it looks as though I may have to go back to Rome next week. But I shan't leave Oxford till Monday. On Sunday, there's a concert at Balliol. You'll have to wear your gown again, I'm afraid. But will you come to it? We'll have one other gaudy night and comfort ourselves with the Bach concerto for 2 violins. And after that, I shall be clearing out and leaving you to...
To what?
To whatever you wish. To your writing. To Oxford, perhaps. But say you'll come. It's a beautiful night. Far too good to waste. Don't go back yet. Come down to Magdalen Bridge and send your love to London River. There's something about this place that alters one's values. I've said a good deal to you one way and another lately. But you may have noticed that since we came to Oxford, I have not asked you to marry me.
Yes, I had noticed it.
I've been afraid because I knew that from anything you said to me here, there could be no going back. But I will ask you now. And if you say no, I promise that this time I will accept your answer. Harriet, you know that I love you. Will you marry me?
Tell me one thing, Peter. Will it make you desperately unhappy if I say no?
Desperately? My dear, I will not insult either you or myself with a word like that. I can only tell you that if you will marry me, it will give me very great happiness.
I reached out and laid my hands on the fronts of his gown, searching for words. But it was Peter who found them for me, in the Latin of the degree ceremony, where the vice-chancellor takes off his cap and asks whether it pleases the doctors of the university that a candidate should be admitted to a degree. Peter bared his head and stood with his mortarboard in his hand.
Plaquette, magistra?
Plaquette.
Harriet.
And the proctor, stumping grimly past, averted his eyes from the spectacle of two senior members of the university in their academic gowns, passionately embracing.
In Gaudy Night by Dorothy L. Sayers, Lord Peter Wimsey was played by Ian Carmichael and Harriet Vane by Joanna David. The Warden, Jill Balkan. The Dean, Francis Jeter. Miss Lydgate, Elizabeth Proud. Miss Devine, Sarah Lawson. Miss Hilliard, Elizabeth Bell. Miss Barton, Carolyn Jones. Annie Wilson, Angela Sims. Miss Newland, Nicola Holmes. Viscount St. George, Tom George. Paget, Don McCorkindale. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Gaudy Night was dramatised by Michael Bakewell and directed for BBC Audiobooks by Enid Williams.